Hello and good morning, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today's Wednesday, April 10th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Nicole Nelson. Hey, Nicole.
Good morning.
And our guest this morning, we have three guests. The first half, we have Kevin Smockler, and in the second half, we have Peggy Payne and Jillian Lauren. First up is Kevin Smockler. He's been called a publishing visionary by the Huffington Post. His writing on the arts and technology has appeared in the LA Times, Fast Company, and on NPR. He was on the show a few years back as the editor of the anthology Bookmark Now, writing in Unreaderly Times, a San Francisco Chronicle notable book of 2005. Kevin has a BA in writing seminars from Johns Hopkins University and an MA in American Studies from the University of Texas at Austin. He's a native of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and lives in San Francisco. And the book he's here to talk about today is his essay collection called Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. You know, I loved Bookmark Now. I still have it, and I was excited to see your new book about books.
Thank you.
Yeah, talk about how the idea crystallized and resulted in Practical Classics.
Absolutely. So Bookmark Now is clearly the product of sort of youthful indignation and self-righteousness to some degree. It was a book about that I'd written shortly after the NEA's Reading at Risk study talked about how people raised with computers and who were of the internet generation were no longer interested in books and reading, and Bookmark Now was begun in the flames of, oh, yes, they are, I'll show you how much. This book is Practical Classics certainly comes from the point of view of someone who is nearing middle age. I'm going to be 40 this summer, and having and looking back upon my own education, both with books and otherwise, and realizing that I actually knew a lot less than I thought I knew. And I had the germ of the idea came from my 20th high school reunion when I spent some time with my teachers, and we reminisced over our experiences there, and I could remember very little of what I had actually read. So I was curious about the idea of rereading those books and getting reacquainted with them, my teachers, as an adult. But I didn't want to just say, oh, I should reread some first of all, Kevin rereading books from high school is boring to anyone who isn't Kevin's mother, and the idea of rereading books from high school just because they were from high school lacked a certain punch to me also. So I wanted to I wanted the emphasis on the word practical, which is based on the theory that we reread great books as, that we might have seen as teenagers. We reread them as adults because great books are a map as to how to lead great lives.
Hmm. How did you pick the books that are here, and did you leave a lot out?
Oh, yes, hundreds. I left hundreds out. If there is a sequel somewhere in my imagination, Practical Classics 2, 3, and 4, it will be filled with books I had to leave out this time. The ones I picked here were on the advice and counsel of my teachers from high school. I asked what they had assigned me. I also wanted to make sure there were some books both from my parents' generation and the generation of kids that are graduating high school now and a few years ago. I didn't want this book to be some time capsule of the early 90s when I graduated from high school. And I also wanted to make sure that the book was reflective of how we approach literature in the 21st century, meaning it wasn't just a collection of dead white males.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you're turning 40 soon, and I noticed in a lot of the essays you mentioned the age of the author, or you placed the generation of the book along the author's own timeline. Do you think that the age of the author affects the work, or do you seem to have an increased appreciation for where the author is in his or her life when he or she writes the book?
Yeah, only insofar as age is a sort of, you know, milepost of where we are in life. And when I was putting the proposal for this book together, I my editor and I, the editor I ended up working with, and I talked a bunch about how much biographical information on the author we thought was necessary. And I'm like, and my thinking was, if we didn't know where the author was at in their own life, we were missing something about the story of this book's creation and the story of what it ultimately contains. Mm-hmm. I know there is a school of thought that the text is king or queen and stands on its own, but to me that's like saying the book was sort of delivered here by angels and has no social or political or historical or even psychological or spiritual context. And to me, the context is as much part of the story as what the book itself contains.
Hmm. You know, one thing I really like about this, too, is, and what I liked about Bookmark Now, is your voice. I think, you know, books like this, we can go, okay, another book about the books we should read. Or the part of the joy in reading this is really your voice of in writing the book and you know, the fun in just reading it as opposed to what book should we read. My sense is that your voice has always been with you, and it's there no matter what you read. I could be totally wrong, but maybe talk a little bit about voice, especially in regards to writing nonfiction.
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing professionally for 22 years, since 1988, so almost 25 years. But I've never been able to write. I've never been the kind of person who can camouflage themselves in what they write. People read what I write and say, it sounds just like when you talk. And I take that as a compliment, and I take that as a pretty accurate reflection of who I am as a person. Because to me, writing is not a dramatic performance or a monologue or an interpretive dance. It is a conversation with the reader. And so the conversation shouldn't sound all that different than how it would sound if you and I were sitting across a table together. I am just now in my late 30s, after doing this, you know, for 20 years now, getting comfortable with the idea of being a little bit more florid with sentences, of maybe putting, of arranging words in a way that I wouldn't in everyday speech. But I am totally aware that is a gesture, that is performance, and it's not the heart of how I actually prefer to write. In terms of it sounding fun, I don't know any other way, number one. And number two, I kind of felt like everybody who's going to be reading this book is a busy person who has 100 other things they could be doing with their time, and they are honoring me and my this crazy premise of mine to say, yes, I am curious about the idea of rereading books from high school because you have put this idea before me. And so the very least I can do is make it entertaining. If they, you know, pick over two or three of the essays in this book and say, well, that was pleasant, and they move on to something else, that was pleasant is enough of a compliment for me.
Yeah.
Enjoyable first and foremost, which, not coincidentally, is my attitude towards high school classics as well.
You are listening to Writers on Writing, and we're here today with Kevin Smockler. His book is Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School, published by Prometheus. And this would be a great time to hear you read. Just give us a taste of the book so that everyone can hear the voice and get a sense of the book.
Sure thing. This is from the introduction. So I must have been a nightmare in high school English class. English was my favorite subject, and I'd loved reading since before I could crawl. My friends and I talked about books with the same mania with which we hoarded quarters for the arcade and wolfed down mozzarella sticks at Denny's. I even had English teachers I liked and kept in touch with to this day. But with the self-righteousness only an adolescent boy can invent, I saw these teachers as criminals who had stolen books I would have otherwise enjoyed beside a swimming pool or in a beanbag chair and turned them into something to be dissected, tested, essayed upon, and graded. I didn't care what they did with calculus or with chemistry or with Spanish. Just leave my damn books alone and don't spoil them with education. The jerks. Teaching me was their job, and I saw it as a betrayal akin to spending a day at the amusement park and then getting socked with a final exam on roller coaster physics. I was an imbecile, but I believed I stood for some literary justice only I was equipped to protect. Books were an essential part of my fun, and you dare make them obligatory? What's next, turncoats, an in-class essay on The Legend of Zelda? So I spent the better part of my high school English career beating this drum filled with nonsense and generally making everybody else's experience a drag. The moron in this scenario was me. I was being martyr for a cause that no one supported and that I invented because it felt right, because being righter than thou felt good. But if all that's true, why, until very recently, did I still feel the same pang of resentment upon visiting books from high school as an adult? It certainly wasn't the book's fault, but somehow I was blaming them for sucking the fun out of reading. In my memory, I've conflated not only The Scarlet Letter and O Pioneers with killjoying, but also with bad complexion, awkward prom dates, and final exam cramming. And if high school were the best years of your life, you probably weren't spending them reading anyway. We're perfectly aware that time has passed and that we've all changed, that we can read whatever we want for whatever reason we want. But we still see a book from those days long ago and think, I remember that from high school, and then we sigh. Would you like me to go on?
No, that's great. No, because we have so little time to talk, and I really have so many more things I want to talk to you about. But I love that, and I was thinking in regards to this book that Robert Gray, I think he was a bookseller at Manchester Books in Vermont and now does a lot of writing on books. He was on the show a few years back, and he talked about how, we sometimes get trapped into thinking that only new books are the ones that sort of matter in a way. You know, like if a book's released but it's a couple years old, maybe it's just not worthy anymore of our time. But he said, and I love what he said, a new book is one that a reader has never read. So it doesn't matter if a book is 5 years old, 10 years old, 50 years old, 100 years old. If you've never read it, it's a new book. And I love that about your book, because there's a bunch of these I haven't read that, now I'm kind of considering it.
Oh, I'm always happy to hear that. Thank you for saying that. I absolutely agree, and I think people have said that pretty much that expressed that sentiment to me before while I've been on book tour for this book. And what I like to say is when it comes to books is not a compliment. New is not a value judgment. New is simply a state of being. And my fear is that if we set ourselves in the mentality that a book that is new requires to be first in line over books that aren't new, then we are putting ourselves on a kind of hamster wheel as readers we are never going to be able to get off, because there will always be new books and they will quickly become old books. And it feels to me like kind of eating popcorn, eating and not sumptuous feasts. It feels more like snacking to be only interested in books that are sort of fresh out of the oven. And I like that older books do not place the same kind of urgent demands on our time. That with an old book, because it is an old book, and I'm air quoting with old now, the word old, we can sink into it. We can take our time. We can have it can be a 9-course feast or a four or five hour conversation when you don't realize that dawn has just broken. And to me, that is the deep joy of being a reader. I like the excitement of grabbing a new book as much as the next person. But to me, that's only one kind of reading experience. Mm-hmm. And for something that is as wonderful and pain free as reading, I wish to avail myself of all of the kinds of reading experiences. And I think, and as I have, as I've been saying, this book, Practical Classics, will not tweet at you. It will not status update you. It will not demand you cast aside your other priorities and get to it immediately. It will be there for you. All the books it contains will be there for you. And I see that as a reminder that as readers, we have more time than we think.
Mm-hmm. And this is another reader-like question. You mentioned that you'd rather disappear into a world not so much like yours. And you also say that the adult you picks up a book to be shaken, not given a hug. Is that... I like that. Is that something that has changed with your reading habits, or have you always felt that? Or
I don't know. I mean, I would be lying if I said that Judy Blume's Tales of the Fourth Grade Nothing wasn't one of my favorite books of all time, because I am the oldest child with you know, when I was nine, what I perceived as obnoxious little brothers. You know, that experience certainly spoke to me when I read it as an elementary school student. But I would say in most of my adult life, I, particularly after I crossed the sort of 30-year-old threshold, I feel like my relationship with fiction is one of visiting foreign countries. I do not need my own, and this is just me, I do not need my own experience reflected back to me in fiction. That's not the relationship I have with fiction. My feeling is I know me, and I know what I like, and there's a certain, and if I just spend times or if I just spend my time around fiction that reaffirms my own view of the world, it feels a little self-indulgent. It feels to me like only listening to music that came out when you were in the ninth grade. Now, I am perfectly aware that that is a sentiment that often comes with a certain degree of privilege. And if a reader grows up never seeing their own experience in fiction, the need or the desire to see it represented there is very real. And I don't speak to the validity of doing that. Or criticize it for one moment. Speaking only for me, though, I feel slightly guilty reading Nick Hornby because I'm a mid-30 or late-30s white guy who collects vinyl. and I feel like that makes me like a demographic type, like his reader and not Kevin anymore. So I would much rather read about, like, the Empress, you know, the Empress of 19th century China than that.
It's interesting.
But having read that, I was just with that in mind. Then you talked about Portnoy's Complaint, and you're returning to it and then finding different layers there as opposed to just a reflection of yourself, which you saw the first time.
Yes. I was convinced, wrongly, that when I read Portnoy's Complaint, I believe I read Portnoy's Complaint like my sophomore year in college, actually, and I was convinced that it was, as a Jewish person, it was the same as an African-American wanting to read a book where all of the characters, like lug watermelons and drink malt liquor. I thought it was just a bunch of ethnic stereotypes, Portnoy's Complaint this is, and I would essentially be reading a book about self-hating, complaining Jews who had you know, inappropriate relationships with their mothers, and so I judged it summarily and walked away. And coming back to it 20 some odd years later, I realized that the great feat of that book, or at least one of them, is how gleefully Philip Roth plays with those stereotypes, and how he sort of doesn't dwell on them, but he just kind of brushes past them, and he seeks to top himself with more and greater stereotypes. And the fact that the entire book is set in one room, he imprisons us not only in the therapist's office, but in Alexander Portnoy's head. And so it's an almost like Andy Kaufman act of listening to a person spin off their axis, and you're exhausted from laughing, but you're also exhausted simply from being there. It's a kind of comedy of attrition that I think is just brilliant.
You know, I there's so much more yet, and we have probably 3 minutes left, but I love the titles of these chapters, and some of them have drawn me to these books because of the titles of your chapters. And you know, I've had Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep on my shelf now for probably since I saw Blade Runner and wanted to read the novel that it came from. But I was wondering, in writing this, were there any books that you revisited that became a favorite, that maybe back when you read them in the early days or in high school or college, that you couldn't stand?
Yes. I am the world's biggest Edith Wharton fan in training now, thanks to doing this book. I had read her in conjunction with the Martin Scorsese movie release of The Age of Innocence in the early 90s, and just decided that as a gabby Midwestern Jew, Edith Wharton's restrained New York waspy aristocrats had nothing for me, and I was completely surprised and enchanted with how much I loved The Age of Innocence and how much it was about so many other things than the circumstances of its characters, including how we react to change, how we process pain and loss, and how we ultimately make the decisions that define our lives. I can't wait to dive into more Edith Wharton and I'll probably fit a biography in there of her too, because I just find her a remarkable artist and person as well. Hmm. So that's the first example I can think of, but there were tons.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, in closing, I wonder if were any surprises apart from, you know, discovering that you now love Edith Wharton's work, but any surprises in writing this, whether it had to do with the actual books or the process of writing this book?
The surprise I found is that often the first idea we have about a book, minus the historical context, minus the sort of second go at it we get with rereading, is an understandable judgment, but possibly a misplaced one. I was perfectly convinced that no one out of high school should reread A Catcher in the Rye because Holden Caulfield was the archetypal teenage brat. And then I learned that J.D. Salinger started writing the character of Holden Caulfield when he was a soldier at D-Day and seen dozens and dozens of his friends die. And Holden Caulfield has a recently deceased younger brother, and perhaps Catcher in the Rye is as much a book about sadness and grief as it is about being a bratty teenager. I was convinced Emily Dickinson was a sort of frail flower of a shut-in because that's all I had ever seen about her. And then I realized that Emily Dickinson in her prime wrote 6 and 7 poems a day for years at a time and corresponded with the great poets and artists of her day and was constantly working to make herself better. And that Emily Dickinson was a fierce warrior for the craft of poetry and not some fragile shut-in afraid of the world. There was, you dig a little deeper and remove yourself from who you were in the 10th grade, and the books just open up before you. You know,
yeah.
Italo Calvino says there's a classic is a book that never runs out of things to say.
Mm.
Absolutely, my experience writing this.
Yeah, that's great, and I'm so sorry we have no more time left, but I am going to guess that there's a lot of info on your website for people to go to and find, and maybe find you somewhere. Around the country or the world. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sure. That was Kevin Smockler. His book is Practical Classics. We're going to take a real short break. We will be back with more authors, so stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Listen to Writers on Right
every Wednesday morning
at 9 a.m.
with Miss Barbara
and Miss Murray.
Did we say it was Wednesday?
Wednesday!
At 9?
Wednesday!
In the morning?
Wednesday!
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We were here in the first half with Kevin Smockler, and we're back now with two more authors. It's me, Barbara DeMarc Barrett, and Nicole Nelson. Hey.
Hello.
And we're here in the darkness of Studio A having a wonderful time, and there's never enough time with the authors we have on, but we make the best of it. And you can always go to penonfire.com later, and if you only caught part of the interview, I podcast anywhere from, you know, a few days to a week or two after the shows. So do visit the website. We also have some salon events, some speaker series events coming up. I don't know what that was, but something happened. And anyway, I don't know what happened. But so we have Peggy Payne and Jillian Lauren with us. And let me just get myself together here. Okay. Peggy Payne is a novelist, nonfiction writer, and private editorial consultant. Her research for her travel writing and novels has taken her to more than 25 countries. Her novel, Sister India, was a New York Times notable book. Her work has been cited in Best American Short Stories and published in anthologies, including God Stories, edited by Atlantic Monthly fiction editor Michael C. Curtis. C. Michael Curtis. New Stories from the South and Remarkable Reads. And her most recent work is Cobalt Blue, a novel published by Round Fire Books. She's going to be on my panel next Sunday, April 21st, at the LA Times Festival of Books. It's a fiction panel, I think in the late morning, afternoon. I'm not really sure. I need to look. But joining her this morning and on that panel is author and performer Jillian Lauren. Her writing has appeared in the Paris Review, the New York Times, Vanity Fair, LA Magazine, Opium Magazine, and more. And her first book, well, we're going to talk about this because it was the first published book, is her memoir, Some Girls, My Life in a Harem. And the novel she's here to talk about today is called Pretty, published by Plume Penguin. Hi, you two.
Well, hello, Barbara. Hi. And hello, Jillian.
You're all there.
Thank you.
I'm so glad. Ooh. We're having some technical issues. But anyway, let's carry on. I'd love to begin with the two of you talking about your novels and how they each came about. Do you want to start, Jillian?
Sure. How it came about.
How Pretty, How did Pretty come about?
Okay. Well, Pretty, actually, I wrote it before I wrote my memoir, even though they were published out of order. So Pretty was really my first book. And strangely enough, the book is set in a beauty college, and I was actually attending a beauty college at that time, and they would have these study sessions in the afternoon, and I felt it less important that I study, you know, manicure pedicure theory, and so I started writing, and I was just writing about all the people that I was observing and things they were saying and everything I was smelling and seeing. And eventually those notes turned into the novel, you know, sort of became the seed that became the novel.
Interesting. What about you, Peggy?
Well, my book, I started also before before some of the ones that have been published since. And it was after my first novel, Revelation, came out, and I thought to myself, there was a lot of heavy stuff in that book, and I thought, well, a nice bedroom comedy, how about that? I'll go back to that old story again. And it did not turn out to be a comedy. It turned out to be bedroom, for sure, but it gradually became more psychologically complex and darker. I don't know, I like to poke around in a tumultuous psyche, I guess. And then the supernatural spiritual rose up underneath it. That's how it felt. So it's happened in many layers.
Jillian, I had a question. This is Nicole. I had a question about Pretty and your choice to write it as fiction, because as a memoir writer, did you ever consider using the material in Pretty as a memoir as well?
No, you know, I started as a fiction writer, really, and I came to memoir a little bit later, and personal essay and my nonfiction work, which is what I'm still doing now. But I really started from a fiction perspective, and just because I culled many of the details from my life, the narrative is entirely invented, and I never considered writing Pretty as a memoir. But I really think that I've been able to use sort of, you know, the lyricism of fiction writing and take it into nonfiction work, and the kind of the journalistic eye that I apply to my nonfiction work, and hopefully bring it to my fiction.
Mm-hmm. You know, and as both of you have said, you know, these novels have an element of darkness to one degree or another with both of them. They're quite different, but how do you feel, or how do you deal with, or do you deal with readers or perhaps relatives or close friends who say, I didn't know that about your psyche. I didn't know you felt that way. I didn't know you had this dark side. I mean, do you ever hear that? And if you do, what do you do with that?
Well, I've heard quite a bit of it, and one thing I say is, well, you have to be in pretty solid psychological condition and happy to deal with some of this stuff at great length. So that's one way, and then there's the extremely racy element, and I have not figured out what to do but shrug, smile, say, hope
right.
You like it, sorry if you didn't.
Yeah, that's interesting. What about you, Jillian?
I don't think anyone was ever very surprised. But I do think that people were surprised when my memoir came out. Sure, they were, because it's 20 years later, and, you know, I live like, you know, I'm a mom, and I live in a nice suburban street, and you know, I never really mentioned the whole harem thing very often. I mean, now I do, you know, but now it comes up, because people go, oh, what's your book about, you know? So, but before that, it never really came up, you know? It doesn't come up in Gymboree or at Block Party or whatever. But... you know, yes, I deal with that. I deal with some disbelief, and then I kind of, like, have to watch people integrate that. But, I mean, the fact is that as artists, really, what we're doing is kind of volunteering to, like, take the dark stuff and the shameful stuff and the joyful stuff and the... and sexy stuff and all of that, and really, like, live in it in a very public way, whether we're writing fiction or nonfiction. But it's really, like, everyone's got that stuff.
Yes.
You know, we're just grappling with it in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you just have to kind of, like, accept that and own it, and You know, and I really feel like it's a privilege to be able to do that.
Mm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. We're here today with Peggy Payne. Her new novel is Cobalt Blue, and Jillian Lauren, and her novel is Pretty. And I would love to hear both of you read from your work. Is that possible? Do you have books nearby?
Sure.
Okay. Peggy?
Yeah.
Yeah, just a couple of minutes, just to give our listeners a taste of your work.
Do you prefer a ricier page?
No, probably not. Probably for a G-rated audience here on the radio.
Okay. Well, this is from my main character's childhood. She is traveling with her parents, as she did all over the world as a kid. And she has just seen India in daylight for the first time. Probably nine there. And Zach is her father. Zach was still sound asleep, Mom taking a shower as Andy tiptoed in from her adjoining bedroom. With the window slats closed, their room was dim, shadowy gray-white like the tangled sheets. She needed to tell them to look out the window. He was breathing slow and loud. One bare grown-up foot, all its bumps and hard places, stuck out from under the sheet. He looked too big for the bed, and his hair was standing up from the way the side of his face was pushed down into the pillow. She almost touched, the sole of his foot with the tip of her finger, close enough to feel warmth coming from him, but not to wake him up. Her mother stepped out of the hotel bathroom, enveloped in steam, her hair wrapped up in a towel. She had on her little satiny robe. "Hey, sweetie," she said, "you're all dressed." Zach rolled over on his back then, stretched his arms out wide, reaching past both edges of the narrow double bed. "Good morning," he said, then seeing Andy, "how's my baby?" She pointed to the window. "Did you look out there?" "Not yet," he was yawning. Mom sat down next to him on the bed, unwinding her hair. Zach put a hand up and started rubbing her back, his fingers going up and down the long dipped-in part where the backbone was. His eyes closed, as if he was going back to sleep. Andy watched his hand rise and fall, slow and lazy, felt almost as if she was going back to sleep too, or swinging in a slow swing that carried her up so high she felt the motion sway her insides.
Hmm, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Peggy Payne reading from Cobalt Blue. How about you, Jillian? Can you read a little bit from Pretty?
Sure. So this is the main character, Beebe, is in recovery from drugs and alcohol and is falling off the wagon here.
Okay.
"I go back to the dairy case to look for the rice pudding, planning to open one and eat it right there in the store. I do this sometimes, but when I get there, I realize I don't have a spoon. How this works is that you have to get the spoon first from up at the front. The whipped cream cans are lined up like little soldiers. I grab a cold cylinder and aim to shoot the whipped cream straight into my mouth. I don't know what happens, where the lapse is between thought and action, but I don't tilt the can the right way. The choice isn't a choice. It's pure momentum. I hold the can upright, push out all my breath, insert the plastic nozzle into my mouth, and suck the first spray of sweet, sour, limp liquid, and then the slightly chemical-tasting nothing, cold air. Suck and let the poison fill me, and then hold it in my lungs until they ache. Perhaps the lamest relapse in all of addict history, sucking whipped cream cans at a Ralph's. I'm already reaching for another one as the sparkles close in. I can't feel my mouth, and then I can't feel my body. I sink to the cold floor in front of the dairy case, and when I begin to come around, I see a red-aproned fat white man hurrying toward me. I gauge that I have time, grab for one more can, and suck the nitrous out as fast as I can. Far away in my body, someone's hands drag me by under my arms. By the time we reach the door, I've regained consciousness. I scramble to my feet as he attempts to haul me out. He keeps stopping to huff and puff dramatically. As I stand up, I hear him say, "Sorry, Manny, I'm going as fast as I can. She's a big 'un."
Thank you so much. That was Jillian Lauren reading from Pretty, and Jillian and Peggy Payne will both be on the panel at the LA Times Festival of Books on April 21st, and Nicole has gratefully informed me that the panel is at 1:30 on Sunday, and it's called Tangled Lives, and there will be two other authors on that panel, too. You know, Jillian, you mentioned when you first came on about Some Girls, the memoir, that you wrote the novel first before the memoir, but then the memoir was released first?
Yes.
Why did they do that?
The memoir was released first.
Yeah, why did they do that?
I think it was a marketing decision on their part. So, I sort of feel like they're in charge of this. Mm-hmm, like, they know better than I do about the marketing aspects of it. So, and I felt fine about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful book, and it gosh, it did well. And continues
to. Some girls are pretty, yeah.
And what were you going to say about Some Girls?
Nothing.
Oh. Nothing. Okay. You know, I was thinking, too, with both of you, that you both write in many different genres, and how do you decide where the ideas and writing fall? I mean, you know, is it a short piece? Is it a long-form work? Is it this? Is it that? I mean, how do your ideas sift into context? Peggy, we could start with you.
Okay. When I first started writing professionally decades ago, it often had to. I was writing nonfiction for magazines and newspapers, and their requirements dictated what I was doing, the length. And then I moved into writing fiction, and the stories dictate what size they should be. And on the fiction versus nonfiction, I make it fiction if I make it up and nonfiction if it's true.
Mm-hmm.
That part is pretty simple. But I have the feeling that the stories are organic, ready to be born, and they're already the size they want to be, and you just kind of haul them out.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Jillian?
You know, I totally agree. I think that is beautifully put, that they are, it's sort of fully formed somewhere. I mean, I have tried, there have been times when I've tried to be more strategic in terms of like, oh, you know, it would be really good. The thing to do right now in my career would be to write this essay that's about this long and could go in this magazine. And it doesn't work that way. Like, there will be something that's announcing itself to me, and usually that thing will be pretty persistent. You know, like I'll try other stuff. I get a couple of false starts, and then this thing that just keeps nagging at me is going to be the thing that gets my attention, and it usually presents itself in a voice and in the sort of, like, organically, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, that it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I also, you know, you both have mentioned allowing autobiography or tidbits from your lives to find their way into your fiction. And how do you decide? I mean, do you just, again, is it like an organic process of something just comes up that seems to make sense to be in a novel or be in fiction just okay? Or do you put it in, through any kind of, way of deciding or any kind of, well, run it through this criteria and I'll write about it if...
Nothing so conscious and rational for me. my most autobiographical novel is Sister India,
mm-hmm.
And it was set in Varanasi, a Hindu holy city on the Ganges, used to be called Benares, and I lived there 3 months doing research. And such dramatic events happened while I was there that they were irresistible to use. And also, I couldn't make up life in India as well as I can life in the U.S. I've lived here a lot longer, so I wound up using a lot of details and incidents and conflicts on that one. But for Cobalt Blue and Revelation, I made it up, and I used just bits of setting. That's the part, you know, picking up gestures from people and what the inside of a particular church is like, or a particular county fair, whatever. It's just familiar backgrounds for me in my U.S.-based fiction.
What about you, Jillian?
You know, I also feel like it's not a very conscious process. But how I don't choose what's going to be fiction and nonfiction is what is most comfortable for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I teach also, and a lot of people struggle with, is this fiction or is it a memoir? And they're facing questions of like, oh, well, this is going to hurt my family, or this is going to... And I just think that it's not really the right place to ask that question from, because I think that it should serve the work
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily the comfort of the artist, you know? So
Sure. It's
usually the most uncomfortable stuff to me will wind up being nonfiction, because that seems like a valuable choice, mm-hmm. you know, in and of itself. So,
interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I made a discovery that really surprised me about self-disclosure. The most forthcoming short piece of nonfiction I've written, I think, or maybe the first, came out in my town here in Raleigh, and I was expecting... people kind of getting in my face about it. And what I found was that people were more backed off. They were a little bit, I don't know, it got a kind of quiet respect or something like that, or maybe they had just heard enough. But a therapist told me at the time, oh, yeah, self-disclosure is very intimidating, which certainly was not my intent and certainly not what I expected.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay.
That is really interesting. I never thought of it that way, but I have thought of it like, well, what are you gonna say about me now?
You've already said it all.
Yeah, I already said it. What are you gonna call me?
This is Nicole again, and I think this question might bear on that. So, Jillian, I was struck that in your novel, you go ahead and write in first person, and Peggy, uh-huh. you chose third. Did any of the, you know, self-disclosure elements or, you know, threats come into those choices or not?
Not for me. It just felt like the voice that arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, particularly with fiction, like, the voice is the most mysterious part of the process for me, and is kind of also the most satisfying and the most magical, and is never really a conscious, like, oh, should I write this in third or should I write it in first? Like, it just sort of is.
Hmm. You never played with it? You never felt like it was too close or experimented in third? It just was clear for you for the whole time that it was a first-person novel?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting voice. I wish we had more time to talk about voice, and maybe we'll do that on the panel when we all meet on the 21st at 1:30 for Tangled Lives, now that I know when it is. But thank you both for being on the show this morning. It was sort of a last-minute thing, and I'm just so happy you could do it, and I really look forward to meeting both of you and talking with you more next Sunday.
I look forward to it, too. Thank you so much.
Yes, me too. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Great, thank you. That was Jillian Lauren. Her book is Pretty, her novel that we're going to talk about on the panel and that we've been talking about this morning. And Peggy Payne and her novelist Cobalt Blue, and we'll talk about that more on the panel as well. What about you, Nicole? What do you think?
I think I'm going actually back to Kevin Smockler's book and thinking about my reading list, actually.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I mean, Kevin Smockler's book is one that, you can read it in pieces, you know, just like read a chapter, I wanted to read about Androids, whatever the chapter title is called, about Philip K. Dick's book that Blade Runner was based on. And, books like that that are broken into sections, you know, where you don't have to read it straight through. You can read a little bit at a time. Makes it, more palatable maybe to find out what I missed in high school and what I should have read or read in a wrong way back when I read it. Or I didn't read half these books in his book, so I can't wait. Thank you out there for being with us. It's been me and Nicole and I here with you, and I guess we'll be here next week too. I'm trying to remember what's even happening next week, but stay with us. Reggae is coming up next, and you've been listening to Pen on Fire. I mean, to Writers on Writing. My book is Pen on Fire. See, I'm like all messed up today. This is 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. See you next week.